what do they say? What do they do? What do other people say about them? And anytime I've ignored that, I've regretted it.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Eamon Leonard. He is the founder of Broadsun VC, the founder of Baseline, and the founder of This Next Thing. Today, you're going to hear how to think intentionally and act with urgency. Here's my chat with Eamon. Going green, becoming more sustainable, it's everywhere, right? Everyone wants to be greener and do their bit to help. But sometimes, for your business, there are more important things to do. It's hard to find the time. Well, take it out of your hands because it's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. They have the time and the experts to sort it for you. And the best bit is, it'll help your business, save you time, money, and energy. Perfect, right? The Green for Business audit will assess your business and tell you where you can make changes. And the new energy efficiency grant will help you pay for those changes. And your local enterprise office will sort the whole process for you. Go to www.allinadayswork.ie/green, fill out the form that takes less than 2 minutes, and your local enterprise office will take it from there. Going green? It's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. Many of you listening to the pod are business owners and savvy investors, but have you been introduced to peer-to-peer lending? Peer-to-peer lending is the practice of lending money directly to other individuals or businesses without the need for a traditional intermediary like a bank. Property Bridges offers you the opportunity to lend directly to experienced home builders across Ireland through their innovative online investment platform. Investors earn returns of up to 9% per annum, and your money is fully secured against property. To learn more, visit propertybridges.com. Property Bridges is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of the Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today. Eamon, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
I kind of have to start with Switzerland because that's definitely one of the most random things I've done in the last couple of years.
It was fun, wasn't it?
It was really fun. But the story is good. Like that email you sent me, I was like...
A week beforehand.
Yeah.
Thanks for being so open and positive to the opportunity.
No bother.
First of all, last minute.
Trying to say yes to exciting things. To be fair,
I agree.
Your copywriting was A1. In
the email?
The copy was strong.
I really appreciate that because I was away for the weekend with Fiona and I was eating breakfast and tapping that out on the phone.
That makes me feel less special, but more impressed.
It was more authentic.
Your copywriting.
It was real.
It was, a very random email about a gathering in Switzerland.
I thought that was a strong opener. Oh,
strong title. I remember I got it I think it was the Sunday, and I was sitting there, and I was like, oh, my wife's like, what? I was like, I don't know. I'm either joining the Illuminati or I'm going on a really cool trip. Either way, good story.
It's definitely the latter.
Yeah, slightly disappointed by that. I thought I had a hood and a secret handshake to come home with. Yeah.
Not yet.
I have to go through the various initiations.
Yeah. Well, people are probably wondering what the hell we're talking about.
Exactly. What are we talking about?
We're talking about a small group of people that like to build stuff getting together in Switzerland. And it was an idea myself and my friend and co-conspirator on these Illuminati type of things, Paul Campbell, and a friend of ours, Abby Phoenix. And the three of us just wanted to get good people together who we thought should get to know each other. Generally, people building stuff, not necessarily technical, but I think probably leaning in that direction. And also not necessarily all startup kind of related, but generally people just thinking about how to build stuff and the meaning behind that, philosophy behind it, and getting to know other people like that. And so we had found this place in Switzerland through deep research that Paul had done on 50 different hotels in Switzerland, and it was a short list of three, and we visited, he and I went over to visit them. We just stopped at the first one because it was so good. We didn't even look at the other two. So
it's ridiculous. If you're not watching on YouTube, go to YouTube. I'm going to flash up an image now of the hotel.
The Grand Hotel Kroninov.
There you go. And I'm going to flash up a couple more images as we're talking. It was ridiculous.
We wanted a place that would fit about 150 people comfortably. And that's a kind of a Dunbar number kind of thing. If it's too much more than that, like maybe 200 or 300, it might be hard to build those, kind of get to know everybody, or at least have a chat with people. And, you know, you're not going to get through 150 people in a few days, but you might walk away with 20 to 25 people that you spent quality time with. But yeah, we wanted a space that would kind of facilitate that, and that people wouldn't have to think too hard about activities or meals, or they just need to have their room key and know where their room is, and we would kind of take care of everything else. And yeah, that hotel really fit the bill. Yeah.
It's an outlandish event, though. Like, how you've pulled that off.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because, like, I can't understate, like, the whole experience was very different because just how you've designed it. Like, I go to a lot of events. I either work at them, host at them, or whatever. And they're all fairly meh. They're all pretty vanilla. They all follow the same template formula. They're all grand.
They all also do a different job.
Yeah, true. But very rarely do you go to something whereby it's been so much thought. Like, I remember you saying on the final night, we spent a year working on this.
Yeah.
And I could see where that was. Sometimes you hear people, I've devoted my whole year to this. And you're like, what the fuck were you doing for the year? Because you definitely weren't planning this. The sandwiches are from O'Brien's.
I will say, O'Brien's wouldn't come that far, unfortunately. I will say that, you know, it was a part-time thing up until it became a full-time thing. As that year goes, when you're planning an event like that, you know, 10 months out, you're like, maybe an hour or two a week, maybe ramping up to something more than that as time gets closer. But like 2-3 months out, you like it is starts to become more of an everyday thing. And there's a lot of moving parts that need to be locked down.
Why Switzerland?
Why? That's a long story in and of itself.
Give us the abbreviated version.
Paul and I had done a thing in Ireland over a decade ago called FunConf, where we had a conference on two party buses, and then we had it in a castle the following year, and then the following year we flew people on helicopters in Inishmore, and then we left it at that because we didn't... What do you do after that? So... a friend of ours who had been to all three wanted us to do something new, and he had just bought a chalet in Switzerland. It was a chalet from Wham's Last Christmas video. I don't know if you remember that, but there's a chalet in Switzerland.
Right.
Anyway, he bought that and he's like, will you do an event in this? So we looked at it. We quickly realized it was too small. But then we were kind of already like, well, maybe we should do something here. And what if it was this and it could look like that? And then Paul did his rabbit hole on hotels and it kind of snowballed from there.
And why do an event?
Why not?
Quick pod. Okay, thanks for coming on, Eamon.
Done. No, but seriously, why not? Like, you know, it's... what I learned from doing FunConf and from doing different meetups over the years is if you're early in your career, it can be one of the fastest ways of leveling up or getting to know people quickly. If you're the person to bring people together, they'll remember you as well as the people. Mm. When you go to things, they might remember you, but they'll also remember the person that put it together. And so you can start small, you don't have to do crazy stuff. You can start small, organize a small dinner, or lunch, you know, invite 5 or 10 people, maybe do that regularly. You quickly build up a small network. And this is where networking can be good as opposed to the transactional type of networking that lots of people have experience with and probably come away with negative thoughts on it because it feels like transactional.
It's horrible.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, there's the opportunity is there for people to create these. Nobody has a monopoly on these types of small intentional gatherings. And It's not easy to do, but it's also not, it's not rocket science either, right? It's not really hard to do. And you can start small and build your way up. I think it's definitely worth doing.
What? It was very unusual in the fact he flew into three cities. Just give people a flavor of how it worked. He flew into three different cities.
Yeah.
Picked your adventure. I tried to describe it to someone when I came home and I'm like, it's kind of hard to describe.
Good. That's good.
Yeah.
No, that is good. That's the kind of outcome that we wanted. We started from like, what do we want people to be feeling the day they leave? What do we want people to tell others a week after, a month after, a year after?
I thought about it on the journey back.
What's the residual,
yeah,
you know, and when people then revisit in their heads when they're having a casual conversation with somebody, how do they describe it? And we want it to be one of those things where people try different ways to describe and then they're left with, look, you just have to be there.
Yeah, that's the best, isn't it? Like, because it adds that feeling of, damn it, yeah, missed out.
Yeah. So, we it's an event in multiple stages, really. So it starts off on a Sunday night in three different locations, Zurich, Innsbruck, and Milan. And then there's like a dinner, meetup, drinks, that kind of thing, getting to know you. But it's a smaller group in each place. So the overall group is divided into three. So that's intentional. And even this year, what we did was we divided each of those groups into even smaller groups so that they would have small dinners. And we asked different people to lead dinners of like 6, 7, 8, 10 people in different places. And what that meant was you could come to this event based on word of mouth that you had heard from last year. You might not know anybody, maybe you do know people, but you turn up and it's not overwhelming. It's not like, well, there's 150 people. It's like, here's 7 people I'm having dinner with in Zurich, and I've never been here before, and it's a lovely sunny evening, and what a great dinner. Now we're going to this bar to meet up with other people that have been having dinner around the city. Mm. And now I'm meeting other people, and the Irish ambassador to Switzerland came along. You started in Zurich.
I was hanging out with her. Yeah. She is brilliant. She was so much crack.
And she's also very tech friendly.
I thought she was a VC when she walked in. I was like, I'd never met her. I knew Connor,
you know, already,
but I'd never met her. I only heard about her.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she walked in. I was like, oh, there's two VCs here, because they both were in suits. And she came over. She goes, "You Gary?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she goes, "I'm Connor's wife." I was like, "No way! Yeah. I thought you were the money." I was like, "I thought the money had walked in." She was great crack.
It just shows how small Ireland is, even in Switzerland.
Yeah.
But that's the goal, really, just to have smaller groups, people meeting in smaller groups, getting to know each other, and then gradually ramping up. And then the next morning, everybody gets on trains or buses, and they're brought to this tiny little village. Well, not tiny, but it's not big either. It's like 2,000 people, called Pontresina, where the hotel is. And yeah, then more dinners around that town, and more random people being thrown into the mix, and everybody's being in the same boat is a good starting point, you know. So how did you end up here? Where did you start off? Yeah. You know, who did you meet last night?
Because then you have a story already having to do that horrible, so what do you do?
Yeah.
You're talking about other stuff. That was one of the things I picked up on. I was like, this is cool, because you're creating shared experiences from the minute you arrive.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very clever. Like, I was saying it to someone, I was like, there was so much thought on the little things. And you can see that if you've been at a lot of events, you've done a lot of events, you can see where all the little things matter and how the thought went into it. Of like, you get the train together, you go up through the mountains together, even the dinner on the first night, you're like, okay, this is a good way to ease in. But you've already got a shared experience by the time you get there. It's like it's a bonding thing almost.
Yeah. When you say, it's great to hear you say little, so much thought put into little things, because that implies that there was a lots of conversation and deep diving on little things. And there was,
you can see it though,
for, you know, it was probably frustrating for us all at times, but we obsessed about the little details, some more than others. And depending on the detail and sometimes when you're doing that, it's very hard to know how it's going to come out.
Yeah.
Like, there were definitely times where we were asking each other, is this really a thing worth worrying about, or like, if this doesn't exist, would people know?
Yeah,
right. You know,
but you got the major things right.
There is that as well.
And that's then the other, you were able to, yeah, you did the 80-20.
Yeah.
You were able to get a beautiful venue, incredible scenery, everything was, the base was there for like the sprinkles. Some people forget to build the base. They just put sprinkles on. You're like, they just fucking messed it all up. Yeah. Whereas when you got the base, you can add the sprinkles of just all the little touches, all the little bits of surprise and delight.
Well, the other thing friends have told us, and I really like this, and I can see this, I can see aspects of this as well, is where like our personalities come out in this. And so I know there's aspects of this that manifested because of who Paul is and the way he thinks about it. And there are aspects of how people experienced things because of who Abby is and the way she thinks about it. And I would hope I'm in there somewhere as well. And to people who know us, that's a fun thing that they got to spot. Like, I know why we're doing this thing. And I know which one of the three cared the most about this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so having kind of our DNA, our fingerprints on the experiences, I think was important to us. And I would encourage anybody that organizes events to really think about how to, be they very small ones or large ones, think about how, you know, your personality and that of your team is imbued into the experience.
I was just going to say personality and style. They were the two things that I thought about while I was there. I was like, this is done with style, but with human personality.
Yeah.
Usually get one or the other. You know, usually it's all zany or whatever, or usually it's all style and the substance, whereas this is the perfect mix of both.
Thanks, Gary. It's great to hear.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me. It was a memorable experience. It was just so different. What did you enjoy about it? Because you were so deep in it, I could see how much was taken.
I probably missed of it. Like, you never get to enjoy your own thing the way your guests enjoy it, because there's always something that coming up that they don't know about.
Yeah,
right. So none of us really kind of, I would say, while that's going on, we probably sat back and relaxed. But there were, I would say, the last evening, there were times where, you know, I got to caught up with people who I hadn't had a moment to catch up with, and friends and new friends. And yeah, it's a very relaxing place to be able to do that.
So I love that your kids were there.
That was really cool.
Me and you were at the bar in the second hotel on the first night there.
Oh, where we're having the dinners.
Yeah, and we're just chatting. Yeah, yeah. And me and you were going to chat at the bar, and your kids were just sitting there behind. I was like,
drinking Coke.
This is class. It's just different. Like, it was, there was a real mix.
But it wasn't just us. Like, I think there were about 15 or 16 kids there this year. And the hotel had, you know, great facilities. And we had the whole place to ourselves. So the kids had to run the hotel from the moment they got there. They were just,
it was so funny.
And the staff were so friendly and open and, you know, willing to let them have the run of the place and humor them. But yeah, it was just having a big, massive home for a few days, and you didn't really have to worry too much about them. And then of course they got to meet kids from all over the world. And there were kind of two cohorts of age groups. There was, like, let's say, the under eights and the over eights. And so they do different things, and there's different facilities that cater to them. But yeah, it was Paul's original suggestion to make it kind of family friendly. And I definitely was resistant to the idea because I didn't.
Some people want a break.
Well, yeah. Like, I hadn't really spent much time thinking about it, but he eventually convinced me, and it was the right call, I think.
It worked.
Yeah.
Where do all these people come from? Because it was such a mixed bag. And I mean that in the best possible way. Your head.
I think you collected them. Geographically, where they come from? What do you mean?
Obviously, they came from everywhere, right? Yeah. There was a real mix. But like, where... Like, it's not like a normal conference where buy tickets, go on sale and blah, 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 buy now, early bird, all that crack. It was very much like, there was very much a theme, very much curation. Like, how did you get 150 people to Switzerland and have such a high quality of people?
Word of mouth, mostly. Reputation from last year and from the events that Paul and I had done 2011 to 2013. That's pretty much it. It's not something you can cold email people on who haven't heard of it and say, listen, here's the pitch.
This is going to sound strange, but
there's no ROI. You're not going to be able to justify this to your marketing team or to, you know, I don't even know if you can expense this. So yeah, it's a hard one. And this is where the word of mouth really comes in. and the reputation piece, and people vouching for us. Like there was a handful of people, maybe two or three people who signed up, and when we reached out to them, we didn't know them. We reached out to them to ask them how they'd heard about it, and they said, oh, heard about it from this person. And we were like, we don't know that person either. Like, it was like a friend of a friend of a friend. The original friend had gone, but like
right, along the line,
it was like 2 or 3 degrees removed, which I think is a bit mad. But yeah, like I think kind of word of mouth, the distribution of that across different networks, different social graphs, different interests, and how people kind of work or the thing that occupies their time. Yeah, that's probably why we had like. They were mostly people that built stuff because people who build stuff know people who build stuff. And that's probably why there was definitely a technical background to a lot of the people there, because people who build stuff and use technology, they know people who do that. But it wasn't really by design. And I don't think you can do that. I think it's very hard unless you explicitly reach out, identify people and reach out and invite them directly. But that's a different thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what's your day job then? If this is what you do for fun?
I don't know if I did that for fun. it was fun after it was done.
But if this is your weird hobby, what actually pays the bills?
I've founded five different companies over the years, co-founded five different companies over the years. One of them was a consultancy. Four of them were what you'd call startups. There was just a product that sold. Two of them were sold, two of them failed. One of them's still gone. I don't have any more startups in me. And just to cut you off at the pass for that inevitable question that comes in the quick fire round at the end, there isn't another company. So what I have is,
why?
I'm too old, don't have the energy. I'm focused on.
You don't look too old. You don't look too tired.
Okay, it's
all internal. That's your internal
opinion.
Damage.
That's your opinion, Gary.
It's all the scars are on the inside.
I appreciate it though. So myself and my partner in life, my partner in work, Fiona Kelly. She and I started a small syndicate last year called Broadstone, and with the intention of investing in pre-seed, at the experimental, chaotic early stage where there isn't much evidence of traction. There might be a product, there might not be a product, there might be just rough screens, there might be just an idea, there might be some research. Or there might actually be traction. But
what does pre-seed mean to anyone not in the VC or startup game?
Pretty much what I just said. It's your years ago it used to be just seed. You needed seed money. And then just the amounts that were being invested started to get bigger, such that it was kind of hard to justify 4 million as a seed. So what would you call like 500 to, you know, 500,000 to 1.5 as investment. So that's kind of got labeled pre-seed.
Yeah. So the money you start with, essentially, like there's so many acronyms and buzzwords in startups, yeah. Like just the money you start with, money you need to get going.
It's the one you get up and running. It, for some people, it might be an angel round, you know, but anyway, the point is the label is irrelevant. What's relevant is, or what's important really is the, what do you have and what are you investing in? And at that stage, there really isn't much to invest in other than the people. And so that's the bit that we really care about and focus on. And
is that why you're at that level? Is that why you went pre-seed?
First of all, it's where I've spent most of my career as a founder over five different companies. But it is a different type of investing, right? Whether you're investing as a VC, whether you're investing as an angel, whether it's a syndicate, what you look for at that first stage of investing, where there isn't much to invest in or proof of, you know, future success other than what the founders are telling you, that's a different style of investing to Series A, Series B, where stuff has been demonstrated, it's repeatable, it can be mapped out, it can be charted, modeled, and there's data to support that, and that data might exist for, you know, a couple of years beforehand. There's customers you can talk to. There's actual diligence you can do. At that stage of investing, you know, VCs know a lot more. At the earliest stage, it's, and this is where, you know, angels tend to come in, they're investing their own money, they're making their own decisions. They don't have to run it through an investment committee or anything like that. They don't have LPs like a VC would have. And so with that stage of investment, where we come in alongside other angels, it's really all about the people. Do you believe they can do what they say they're going to do? And why do you believe that? And there isn't really a shortcut to that. Sitting in a room and seeing a startup pitch isn't going to make you go, take my money. You have to spend quality time with them. You know, you have to get to know how they think about product, how they think about customers, how they think about problems, how they think about hiring, building a culture around that, how they work as founders, how they think about fundraising, where they really want to go with what they're building, you know, what success means to them. Long-term thinking, all these things.
What do you look for? What do you, when you're sitting there chatting to them, obviously you do it very differently to most people. You spend time building the relationship. What are you looking for in those conversations?
I put a lot of weight in somebody that can clearly communicate and can demonstrate clarity of thought around the thing that they're building. And the reason I put weight in that is that it kind of demonstrates that they spent a lot of time refining that, probably before they actually decided, I'm going to do this. And when you kind of focus then in on that, then there's lots of threads that present themselves that you can kind of pull on around the motivation, like specifically why these people, like why are these the people to solve this problem at this time in this market in this way? And like, you're like, none of that is a predictor of success. And if people think that, you know, you invest in this stage and success is guaranteed, then they've no business in investing in that stage. It's the most riskiest thing people can do with their capital. What you're looking for is somebody that will think intentionally and act with urgency about with the capital that they get, and be able to make decisions based on what they've learned. And maybe be willing to change their assumptions or to learn from mistakes quickly. You're looking for evidence of that in the conversations they have with people. And that can take weeks or months, which is, you know, why, you know, doing events is always a good thing, right? You get to really...
It's starting to make sense now. Yeah,
you get to know people, right?
Yeah.
And they get to know you. By the way, it's a two-way street. Hmm. Not enough founders realize this, I'm afraid. Founders are absolutely, and they should be, interviewing investors for the opportunity to partner with them. People will, you know, that'll have the ability to invest, be it their own cash or their investors, their LP's cash. There's a first-time founders, unfortunately, think that there's like a power dynamic where investors control their future success. They don't, the founder controls their future success, and they get to decide who goes on that journey with them or not. Obviously there's a lot of work to do. It's not as simple as just saying that, right? But I think, yeah, it's definitely a two-way street, and I think founders should really be prepared for that kind of conversation or that relationship building process. They should be pushing back and asking questions, testing investors around like what they like about the space, what they like to look for, you know, what challenges do they think that the startup will have? And if they were in the founder's shoes, what would they do? And you can kind of quickly, as a founder, get to a point where you feel if you trust this person or not, because that's ultimately what it comes down to. Everybody's happy when the deal is happening. And then when stuff goes wrong, and it will inevitably, because startups are hard, you want to make sure that the people that you brought on board as partners, as investors, will be supportive and, you know, not be putting unnecessary pressure. So, it's a two-way street.
I think a lot of first-time founders take the money that's there, not the money that they should take.
I totally understand why.
Yeah, absolutely. There's
pressures, bills to be paid. You want to move fast. You want to hire people. Totally understand why. But
you don't know what you don't know either.
And you don't know what you don't know. Yeah.
So do you, is there areas you look at and go, yeah, these are my areas of expertise? Or are you all about the people? Will you invest in a lot of things?
There's areas that I won't invest in, Fiona won't invest in, because we don't know them.
What are they?
Anthem consumer, e-commerce. I don't know anything about that. And yeah, like we want to be able to help. We want to be able to support. And it has to be more than just the capital that comes from the syndicate. So, yeah. And I think you can't waste vendors' time. You have to be honest and transparent with them up front and say, thanks for sharing the deck. I don't know anything about this space. But here's something I noticed about your deck that you might consider thinking about. I don't think this is for us, because we can't help beyond the, you know, we can't help in the way that we'd like to be able to help. And we think that's like valuable and helpful at the very, very early stages. And I think unfortunately there are investors out there that will kind of drag things and, they won't give clear.
Why is that? Because I've heard that so many times.
Because they're investing other people's money and they have made promises to return multiples, whatever that is, depending on when they raise that money. That could be a big multiple or a small number, small multiple. And they might be under pressure because some of the funds they deployed already may not have gone anywhere. And so they would hate to miss out on an opportunity, which is why they'll have like moving goalposts and say, well, we need to see this, come back to us when you have that, and you come back and they're like, but we also need to see this. And
so they're keeping their options open just in case, because they can.
That's exactly it.
Right.
Whereas, so what I tell founders is if you're not getting a clear yes or no from a fund, just deprioritize them. You can keep them on the list if you want, but like, you don't need to be spending any more time with them. If they really wanted it, they'd be all over you. They'd be making it happen if they really wanted to. So.
I was chatting to a person who works in funds recently and I was like, oh, is it getting tough now? And he's like, nope. There's always, the hardest job for me is getting in front of good founders. He's like, there's always money to be invested. It's finding the right founders is his job. Talk to me then about the areas you do love. What areas do you really, when a deck hits the inbox, you're like, oh, this is definitely worth considering.
AI. No, I had to say that.
there we go. We got that for the algorithm. Click, 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 click. Great. I'll put a clickbait headline on this.
It is funny how all of a sudden out of nowhere, they're like every investor is a AI investor and that's all they invest in.
It rots my brain. I'm like, just don't. I was at I had to do a thing for a meetup thing recently and it was just, they're all AI founders. I'm like, how are you all AI founders? It's not possible.
That won't last forever. The thing about it is that AI definitely has its place, but it's only going to augment or improve or amplify what's already there.
Precisely.
For a small number of extremely well-funded startups that are on the kind of infrastructure side, then people will build on top of them. You know, that's a different story. But like the majority, you know, the real place to be at the moment is if you have existed for a number of years and you have stuff that can be immediately improved with an injection of some API that plugs into any of the AI vendors. That doesn't mean you're an AI startup.
I think that's the piece everyone's missing.
And that's
summarized it beautifully.
Yeah. And I think this is probably, I feel like this is like the fifth or sixth big cycle since the emergence of Web 1.0 that we've been through. And every cycle, it tends to last like 4 or 5 years. And in each of those cycles, there's like a micro. It lasts 18 to 24 months and they all overlap. And like, it was like Web 1.0, then it was like, it started to be like, the democratization of content on the web around 2005 or 6 or 7, and then that became the social web, and then cloud emerged, and mobile as a computing platform, and app stores as a revenue generator channel kind of emerged, and then those two were bouncing off each other for a few years, and then big data came along, and machine learning came along, and then crypto, and then, you know, and so there's always, investors are always going to be, it's all about timing. We need to get in at the right time, that it's not too early, so that like we don't burn a load of money educating the market or investing in people who are going to become incumbents and taken over by the upstarts, but also not too late that we miss the opportunity. And nobody knows until after the fact whether the timing was right or not. And that's why there's FOMO. That's why there's people not giving clear yeses or nos. That's why there's there's hype cycles because everybody's trying to make money, but nobody really knows what they're doing. including me.
No one knows. As people always ask me, like, okay, you've interviewed hundreds of people. Give me the key thing. So it's like, you want the key thing? You want the real insight? Nobody knows what they're doing.
It's amazing. Everyone's
figuring it out as they go.
It's amazing when you have that epiphany. I think I was like 35 the first time I realized that.
There are no adults. We're all just grown up kids.
We're all just making it up as we go along.
And the good ones just look like they aren't.
Yeah.
That's the key. Exactly. How do you sort the signal then from the noise? Because that's your job, essentially, is to figure out, is this a hype cycle or is this actually a mega trend?
I suppose that's grounded in, it's probably easier to figure that out in spaces that you know better. You know, so like one of the spaces I like is dev tools, infrastructure, the stuff that's kind of really kind of behind the tech that people consume. And that kind of is my background, was building apps and doing stuff around cloud stuff back 10 years ago. So it kind of leans into that. And so when you know a space very well, it's very easy to spot bullshit. You know, I think this is why I like consumer stuff. I would stay away from maybe even some types of health tech or e-commerce. Yeah, like I said, I just don't know the spaces enough to be able to separate the bullshit from the substance, from the hype. And I think, I'd imagine like the larger funds that like invest in everything, they have to have like specialists within those kind of market verticals for them to help them navigate that. I don't think anybody has. That being said, you know, if you've been around long enough and somebody's sitting in front of you and they're telling you that they're going to do this, you can probably spot it, you know, or not.
So it's kind of like, pattern recognition over time.
There's a bit of that, but there's a bit of like street smarts, gut instinct, you know. I think the more you ignore your gut instinct and the more you get burnt by ignoring it, the more, you know, you're like, I should have listened to myself.
How do you know what's the gut and what's just the inner voice? What's the difference?
How do you know what's the what?
How do you know what's the gut, though? How do you know what's the gut telling you, not just the inner monologue kind of going, oh, yeah, I should definitely do this. How do you know what's the gut?
Do you not feel it? That's why it's called gut instinct. Do you not like feel like a in your gut?
No, I do. I do. But sometimes you're like, the inner monologue will take over. So how do you listen to it? Is it a feeling?
This is where surrounding yourself with people who you trust is good. Like Fiona and I talk about all the things all the time because we're partners and everything.
All the things all the time.
But we also have friends that we trust, people that we've done stuff with. And I think you have to, you know, there probably needs to be more of a village mentality when it comes to how startups are built. Like a child is raised by the village. Takes a village. I think there is a spirit there that you know, healthy ecosystems should have, especially focus on that early stage of chaos and you know, ideation around it, you know, problem and solution and how you know build a product and commercially execute on that at that early stage, pre-seed to like Series A. I think there needs to be. I think good ecosystems have that village mentality where founders will help each other and they're, you know, people interested in helping them figure that out that, you know, maybe have fucked up a few times and want to kind of nudge them away from and help them navigate that gut feeling versus this sounds right, but I don't know kind of thing. So I think, surrounding yourself with good people, I think is important.
What's the state of the Irish ecosystem at the minute, the Irish startup ecosystem?
Just going to take a drink before I answer this one.
This is where we need the clickbait now. This will be the one that will go viral.
It's the one, this one that gets the likes or the...
Likes, dislikes, whatever. Likes. Make them love you, make them hate you, make them feel something, Eamon.
I think, and I can say this with some degree of certainty, but again, it's grounded in my perspective and it's just my opinion.
Caveat of the way, off you go.
Don't edit that out. Keep that in. But it is. I've been around a relatively long time. In the context of starting stuff up since about 2007. And I wish we had a more evolved ecosystem here from the perspective of more founders from Ireland starting and scaling in Ireland from the perspective of a angel ecosystem grounded in exited founders. We don't have the same depth or density of exited founders that are investing their proceeds or reinvesting even a small portion of their proceeds. We don't have the same depth or breadth or density that other European cities have. And there's, I think there's a couple of reasons for that, but it's a missed opportunity. That's not to say there aren't angel investors. There definitely are. I think angel investors that have made money outside of being founders, that have lost sleep at night, that have created something from nothing, have, you know, done the first 100 sales, have grown a team, have had setback after setback, have had to fundraise through multiple rounds, possibly bridge rounds, and have come out on the far side of that with an exit, with an outcome, and all that experience, and they're willing to take a portion of that and reinvest it back into other founders that are in their ecosystem. They're a different class of angel investor to somebody that made money in property during the Celtic Tiger, for example, or through some other additional business. That's not to say that those people can't be good angels, and it's not to say that they're not valuable and welcome in the ecosystem. It's just that they're different. We don't have enough of the exited founders.
Why not?
Probably a couple of opportunities or a couple of reasons. First of all, probably just don't have enough of the successes. It's probably just a numbers thing, right? I also think that there has been a policy in place at a government level to discourage founders from exiting, because that might mean that jobs are possibly on the line. And, you know, I think that might be short-sighted. And I don't know if that's still the current policy, but it definitely was about 10 years ago. I think those, you know, and I think it's one of those things where just one side of the ecosystem hasn't developed as fast as another side. Like, there are a lot of multinational tech companies here. They employ people, they bring people from other countries to here to pay taxes. They add a vibrancy to the city. They add an extra layer of prosperity to Dublin. I don't know if that extends beyond Dublin to other parts of the country in the same way. But they also, you know, are able to pay people high salaries, and that provides competition, hard competition for talent with startups. I think there's just an imbalance in an ecosystem, and healthy ecosystems, whether like startup or in nature, there needs to be balance. And it feels like for the longest time, there's been an imbalance. And then the other side to it is that I think there's a large part of it is institutionalized, from various different types of government activities, which definitely have their place, and not here to shit on that at all, but I think there's too much of it. There's too much EI money everywhere, directly invested into startups and into funds. So, and then I think sometimes that money might be a bit too easy to come by, and that potentially holds back founders in terms of their ambition. And I know it has a knock-on effect when VCs from other parts of Europe meet Irish founders, like that kind of, it's just another friction point because of the perception of it being, you know, a slow process if there's government money involved, or if one of the things that I would love to see Irish founders do is raise more money abroad, because it means they're competing at a higher level with international founders in front of international funds. And if you're competing at a higher level, then you're automatically.
Iron sharpens iron. We talked about it downstairs. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's a missed opportunity for the ecosystem. I think I would love to see more of that.
Why don't we live on an island? Why don't we do that?
We don't have to stay on an island.
Is that the island mentality though?
It might be a bit of it. I don't know. And maybe some of this is post-COVID stuff. I don't know. But I think there's missed opportunity for founders here. Like it's, 10 years ago, Patrick and John headed off and set up Stripe. Well, more than 10 years ago, right? And everybody goes, why wasn't that built in Ireland? And, you know, they wrote a post about, you know, why they didn't do it. And yet, and people think it's changed, but in, you know, there's companies today that Irish founders have gone to other ecosystems to set up there. Now, some of those might be personal reasons, or some of them might be just that's where their network was or whatever. But like the fact that that's happening tells me that there's still a problem. Something like 150 founders applied to Y Combinator last year, according to a tweet from Patrick Hollison. Like, that's great to see, but also that shouldn't have to be, it shouldn't be necessary that they have to leave. And so when I say I encourage founders to raise money from people in other ecosystems, I don't mean move to those ecosystems. I mean, raise money there and set up here.
Mm.
And the wider ecosystem will eventually benefit from it. That exited founder angel problem that I spoke about would slowly but surely resolve itself.
Do you think world-class massive companies can be built here?
Absolutely, I do. 100%, I believe that. I think a gap needs to be created for that to happen. I don't know if that can happen with a government being the guiding hand on programs and funding and how that's deployed and the kind of constraints that come with that.
So in the morning, you're going to set up a brand new idea to create this gap. What is it?
I've already set it up. It's called Baseline.
It's a nice segue. Yeah, you've done this before.
Or I should say it's in the process of being set up. Baseline is a community and a workspace for as kind of a maybe 10%, 15% of Irish founders that I think will break out in the next couple of years. And it's independent of government funding. We're entirely funded by membership and by private investors and a handful of corporate and venture partners. And it's certainly not to say that what exists currently is the wrong way to do it. It's just that I think there's another way. And myself and Fiona are, you know, putting our money where our mouth is on this. We've taken a 10-year lease on a space up on Thomas Street that is going to be where this community of peers, early stage, pre-seed to Series A, where they manifest, where they hang out, where they collaborate, where they bring their team, where they learn from each other, where they grow. And that's going to be in a very organic way that is plugged into other ecosystems, other similar corners of other ecosystems. But like, yeah, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel, and we don't want to sideline anyone else's efforts. In fact, we think that if we do a good job, maybe a rising tide will raise all boats, and there might be a positive knock-on effect, and we would dearly love for our efforts to improve the ecosystem. And that's why we took a 10-year lease out, because it takes that long.
Mm.
This isn't something you can, it's not like software. You can just, you know, hack something together quickly, stick it up in the cloud, direct some traffic to it, and then make some improvements. It's a physical space. It's probably a changing group of people over time who are going through their own stuff and helping each other out in the process. And we think there isn't really something like that exists. There are definitely programs. There are definitely co-working spaces. There are definitely incubators. This kind of falls somewhere in between all of those things. And it's just a small little footprint for those types of founders to come and be part of. And like I said, if we're successful, it'll be obvious.
Mm.
It'll probably take some time though.
No, you've got 10 years. You'll figure it out. I love you putting money where your mouth is. It's where it's all about. Bring me back to your own journey then, the ones you started and exited. Give me a kind of an overview of those. What did you get involved in?
In 2007, I was turning 30 and I had a crisis that I thought I had wasted my 20s. And so I said, I'm just going to work for myself as a developer. And then, so I built a small consultancy out of that with some friends. And we built product for people, all startups, mostly startups. But yeah, it was, that was like 4 years of just like trying to figure out, like, how do you sell? How do you market? How do you communicate your, what it is you do? How do you bill? How do you invoice?
So startups would come to you and go, we want to build a product for this, or we want to build a feature for this. And you'd be like, no problem. We'll build it and then ship it for them.
But along the way, we were kind of experimenting with different ideas, and trying different things. And, one of those kind of stuck. That was a cloud deployment platform. It's a long time ago now, but we bootstrapped that from the consulting and we sold it after 7 months. We didn't have any other investors. And yeah, that kind of like changed our lives.
In what way?
We had money.
Stop being so vague. Don't be modest. This isn't the modesty house. Come on.
The company hired us. They were a cloud company from San Francisco called Engineered. They hired us. They paid us to acquire us. We got incredible experience for 3 years. We worked there, myself, my co-founders, and some people that we hired here in Dublin. I learned a load in the process, traveled a load to the Bay Area, grew my network, ran some events, got to know loads of people. It was a pivotal moment. I was able to do some angel investing.
Was that a life-changing sum of money, or is that like enough to get you started on the next thing, or what are we talking about?
Somewhere in between. At the time, I probably think it was a lot. It was a life-changing. Yeah, because like I was broke. So like then I wasn't broke. So that's...
Anything is better. Life-changing is more than I have
now. Working for yourself is hard. Selling time is really hard. Mm. And anybody that works for himself as a consultant or a freelancer or even as a small agency of any kind, be it a recruitment agency or a marketing or a web development or design agency, you're just constantly selling time, and you probably don't have more than a few months of buffer in the bank. If you do, you're doing stuff really well, but also like nobody's gonna buy that. Like those companies never get sold because there isn't IP. It's just like a list of clients.
Yeah,
but like,
so you built a product within that.
Yeah, and spun that out. And then...
How did they buy it after 7 months? What was the reason?
Just that good, Gary.
Just that damn good, the special sauce.
It was... I thought it was pretty slick for the time. But really, it was what you call an acquihire. We had visibility and influence in a market that this company wanted to get.
Right.
And this product was a gateway to doing that. And so yeah, it made sense, and it was twice what we thought we get for it, so you don't hang around on that.
Yeah. What did it feel like being your own boss and not being your own boss?
I think good leaders know when to follow. And I really kind of embraced that. I felt I had a CEO now who's telling me what to do, and I took his guidance, and he listened to my opinions and then would tell me what to do.
And good, but also what if you try this? Oh yeah, that's much better.
Yeah, but that's not what we're doing. That's not what we agreed upon at the board. Oh, okay. Yeah, fair enough. So yeah, I think that's you know, earlier on you were saying, what does he look for? I look for stuff like that in people when you're talking to them, is like, you know, can they make pragmatic choices about the big picture stuff? And as a leader of a brand new startup of like one or two or three people, what does that even mean, right?
Strong opinions, but loosely held.
Yeah, you're right. But it also is like, nobody's investing in a three-person startup for where you are now. They're investing in where you'll be in 3 years. That's why conviction in the people is so important at that stage, because there's no other data to go on. And so part of like me investing in you at this stage and it being grounded in where we think you'll be in 3 years' time, part of that is going to be, you're going to have a team of people. Do I think you can lead them? Do I think you can attract them in the first place?
Mm.
Are they going to be inspired to follow you? Are you going to give them the space to grow and develop? Are you going to entrust them and empower them and delegate? in a way that doesn't make you a bottleneck? Are you going to be able to scale your business, your people, your culture? So yeah, I think that's a ramble. I don't know how we got onto that one, but
well, it's good. It was how we made your first 100 million. So after that, 3 years in,
I got the itch, you know, the founder itch again. I wanted to do something else, but I didn't know what. And so I left and just took some time out to figure that out.
How did you figure that out?
I wrote some code, experimented with some different ideas. I talked to people. I decided that I wanted to try and take on LinkedIn and build a professional network that actually had, you know, relationship strength as a thing in it, rather than, you know, oh, here's somebody who I have a first connection with, but I have no idea how I have a first connection with them. We built something that technically worked, myself and a small team. It technically worked, but it was a commercial failure. I was a solo founder, so I have to take responsibility for it. I focused too much on the product and not enough on
distribution,
on sales distribution. Yeah. And this is the thing. I think founders need to be, get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I was comfortable being comfortable, right? I was doing the things that my mind would gravitate towards that I thought would be valuable, but really it was just to, I was probably afraid. Probably afraid to do some of those things. So
it's really interesting though, and thanks for sharing that, because I think a lot of people would look at you after having an exit and doing this, that, and the other, be like, oh sure, he's figured it out now.
I looked at me like that. Like, right. People kid themselves. Like, what the fuck does success mean? Right? If enough people tell you you're successful, you're gonna believe it. And then if your name is in the paper and there's some number beside your name and, you know, people are talking about funding or exits and this and that, you're going to believe that bullshit. Like, very easy to fall into that trap. It's like the difficult second album, right? This brand new band comes out of nowhere and they just they wipe the charts, and then the follow-up. Now the real pressure's on.
Yeah, it's like a massive football fan, and like the difficult second season, they have a breakout season.
Yeah,
they're like the best thing.
Yeah,
and then the second season is an absolute flop because
it's a different thing.
Out. Yeah, they've been figured out. Thing. Everyone knows them now. They're like, oh, he always cuts in off the right. Just cover him on the left foot. He's fine. And they're like, oh shit.
But in a startup case, it's like you're not going to be building the same company again.
Yeah.
You're building a different company, probably solving a different problem in a different market. At a different time period in the cycle.
Did you think it was the same?
Different founders, different team. It's a different thing. Why would it be the same thing?
Did you think it was the same formula though? Did you think, repeat?
I think that was my problem. I don't know if I thought so deep about it.
Okay.
Obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, everybody's wise, right?
Yeah, of course. It's easy now to look back and go, oh, I've just did this, and this.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, we had raised Angel, I put some of my own money in as well. And so we didn't take money from any VCs. And we really, like, I was doing a rolling raise at one point where it was flying close to the wind and it was stressful. Solo founder. I had second child, had been born, just, I wasn't sleeping much. And then I had back surgery and just a few weeks after we launched, and oh yeah, man, it was all over the shop. And, anyway, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Isn't it funny though how we always think progress is linear?
It's not. It's like a roller coaster.
We forget the other shit happens. Yeah. Life.
Yeah.
Great things like kids and partners, but then bad things like surgery and deaths. Like, we never really factor these in. We think of like...
Well, we also think it happens in a vacuum. Like, yeah. Life is some other abstract thing that doesn't happen while this is going on. And everybody has their shit.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize it. Even people that you're in the trenches with building your startup, be they co-founders or employees, everybody has their shit and you have no idea.
Yeah. Everyone's carrying a little bag with all their stuff in it. Like, and it's.
Yes. And this is why, you know, being intentional about how you build culture is important, because people bring that in the door to work as part of the culture. Whether you're in a physical space or hybrid or fully remote, people have that with them. And some people are great at unpacking it and some people are great at hiding it.
Mm.
And it can be very hard as a founder, as a leader, to get the best out of people and recognize that that's a thing and be able to work around it or with it, and give people the space to figure that out as well, while still executing with urgency or having a velocity or hitting all the things you need to hit. Like, it's a big, big balancing act.
There's a lot to juggle, isn't there?
Yeah.
There is a lot to
juggle. Why would anybody be a founder? Why would anybody start something up like it's...
It's lunacy. But if you do, we know where you should go. So then what was the next thing? So you've done 4 or 5?
There was a cloud analytics thing that kind of was probably too early, way back around 2009. It's probably too early to the market. It worked as well, but the customers weren't really there for it. But 3 years later, they were. And there were companies raising tens of millions to solve the problem. That anyway, so timing is a thing.
Been early is the same as been wrong.
Yeah. And then the last one, 2019, I co-founded a company called Boundless, which is an employer of record, employing people compliantly in other countries, doing payroll, taxes, they're doing great. My co-founders, all co-founders, Dean and Emily, they're doing great.
So now, Broadstone.
Broadstone. So then, yeah, COVID, what are we going to do? Let's start Broadstone. What else should we do? Let's do a conference in Switzerland.
What else should we do?
Let's start Baseline. So
you've the three things running in tandem, but yeah. I love the way they all live together. They're all, it's kind of how I think about the podcast. It all runs together. Like, they're all symbiosis of each other.
There's a guy who spoke at our conference last year, Derek Sivers. He's like,
No way.
Do you know him?
Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah,
I love his writing.
He's old school web 1.0.
He spoke last year, did he?
He came last year.
Damn it. He's cool.
And he wrote a post years and years ago about you can be local or global, but you can't be both. And so in the back of my head, with those three, I think of them as projects, or Baseline is my attempt to be very, very local. And this next thing, the conference in Switzerland, is my attempt at being global. And like, there's other people involved in that, but that's like my selfish, that's what I want to get out of it. It's my attempt at being, global. And then Broadstone as a syndicate is like a kind of a tie between the two of them, where it's a foot.
That's the bridge.
It's a bridge where it could be one or the other. There you go.
Hopefully you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests in this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So, why not today? If you want to start up or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today.
You excited?
About what?
You seem very mellow. You seem very chilled. Are you excited about what's coming? Because you've built three things there. You're building three things, early stage. To be honest, they're all three startups. You're only lying to yourself, right? You're only joking.
Maybe
you're only kidding yourself. You're not maybe even kidding me.
If I was excited, I'd probably damage the microphone by getting too loud. So I'm kind of restraining myself. I don't want to hurt your ears. I am. I am. What I get most excited about is when I see founders interacting with each other in the context of something that I've facilitated. And what I get excited about that is that I see potential that they don't see, or it hasn't been realized yet, or may not be realized for years. And so that's, I know it's very notionally and it's kind of abstract and might sound a bit Ponzi, but like I get excited about that, and I really get excited about people who are at the beginning of the ideas, and there's lots of what if couldn't it do that, imagine if you did, just those type of conversations get me really, really excited. And so, you know, really focusing myself in these spaces kind of gives me access to that.
That's not an notion at all. Like, I love building this podcast. People don't really understand where it's going.
I don't understand it, really.
I don't know where it's going.
367.
We'll do 400 this year. Doesn't 400, we'll do 400 at the end of the year.
Congratulations.
But, like, it's going somewhere. I couldn't tell you exactly because I didn't start it as a business. I started it as a way of meeting people like you. And I was just like, okay, this is going somewhere. Even now, I'm constantly going, right, what's going to be the thing? I'm like, I don't know. But I know you're talking about the gut. That's why I teased you earlier about the gut. I was like, in my gut, it's working and it's going to work and it's bringing me in the right direction. I couldn't tell you in 5 years what I'll be. I'll be doing it, but there'll be loads of things around it.
This is a really important point. Nobody knows your business, this particular aspect of your work life. Nobody knows it the way you do. Lots of people have opinions on it. Say you're mad and have you thought about doing this and why aren't you doing more of that? And I don't see how you're ever going to make that. That's totally fine. But nobody's going to know it the way you know it. Historically, how you're thinking about it in your gut, in the future.
You obsess about it.
You absolutely do.
Yeah. I think about it all the time.
Yeah. And I think a mistake I've seen founders, especially first-time founders, make is they'll talk to an investor, they talk to somebody who they think knows.
Yeah.
And then they'll go off with that.
Well, they must know because X.
Exactly.
Nope.
Yeah.
They're giving you their opinion or their experience based on one of their experiences.
I learned this from having kids. there's a whole industry, especially first kid. There's a whole industry of fear around the first kid.
Oh yeah.
And the books, and then there's all the paraphernalia you have to buy, the buggies, the car seats. Do you want to go for the 200 euro seat or the 750 euro seat?
Do you want to keep her safe?
How can you put a price on your child's safety?
Yeah. Oh, we're 19. So we've had our first girl and our first child in general. And it's only now, she's 19 months. She needed 2 years. So now you're like, oh, wow, it's chaotic.
Right.
First year, you're like, yeah. There's nothing you don't say yes to.
Exactly.
You're like, well, I'm not skimping on that.
Yeah, exactly.
She needs that. Just do it.
And then
next thing you know, do that test.
Next thing you know, your home is full of all this stuff that you don't need, and you're like, how did this even get here? What do we do with this? And you can't even recycle it and give it to other first time parents because they're like, no, I think we want the brand new stuff. We don't want the stuff that's been possibly.
I had a good test. I said to every parent I knew, I was like, what's the one thing you bought that actually mattered?
Yeah,
and I asked 20 people.
Is there a common thread or is it all overshot?
Minor stuff.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, you really want to get like the little bouncy seat because they'll get hours in that and you'll get some time to shower.
Yeah. Like,
good advice. Nice.
Yeah.
You want to get this buggy because that fits that. And you're like, good advice. You know, logical, common stuff.
Multi-packs of onesies. That's it. Because that's you can never have enough of them. But there's a whole industry around just books, around advice for the first time. Parents.
Oh, we did every webinar going.
And you consume it, right? And you go deep on it. And then 19 months in, you realize you haven't killed the child. She's doing fine. She's thriving, in fact.
It's all instinct.
Holy shit. I actually know what I'm doing here. Mm. And this is because these books are generalist advice. And they might be written by child psychologists or people who've had 7 kids or whatever. But nobody knows your kid the way you know your kid. Nobody knows your startup, your business, your thing that you spend most of your waking hours thinking about, maybe some of your sleeping hours subconsciously thinking about. Nobody knows it the way you do. And I think more founders need to draw confidence on that. Because everyone can give advice. You don't have to listen to it.
Yeah. And you should get as much as you can get surrounded. That's why I'm so interested in what you're doing. So I think environment is such a key indicator of success. Like where you spend your time and who you spend it with is such a key indicator. Because no matter
how brilliant you are. I don't think it's an indicator of success. I think it just increases your chances. But still.
I suppose. Yeah, that's true.
But
yeah.
Still, it might increase them a few blips out of like 10 million blips.
I think it can kill your chances, though. I think it can be bad advice.
That also, 100%.
I think it can kill you because no matter how exceptional you are, brilliance doesn't really happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, you have the exceptionals, John Collison's of the world. You have those guys. But the majority are like just plugging away, trying to figure out what's
going on. Look, timing is involved, you know?
Hugely. Mm. What's your formula for success? What's your founder formula? I knew you were going to say that. I bloody knew you.
I said
he's going to be contrary. He's going to be like, I don't agree with that. What's your one, though? Like, what have you done that you're like, I did this and this, and that brought me success? Because there is something. Like, I know you don't want to apply it to everybody, but there is something.
I actually did write something down for this because I knew you were going to ask. It's on my laptop. Do you mind if we like?
You can cut just this grab. Bit out while I go you get can my laptop. Just. You can go stage left, grab the laptop, and give me the formula because it's a key piece of the new series. If we don't have this, the whole kind of the new series just kind of falls apart.
So yeah, you wanted a couple of words on the
couple
formula.
Of words. Like, give me a formula. You're a scientific guy.
Well, this one will resonate with you because you actually more or less said this earlier on when we were talking about coming to Switzerland. Be open to change, I think, I will probably get most people through just the ups and downs. We were talking about how it's not linear, right? Being open to change, that could be you need to pivot, or the market has changed, or a competitor has launched, or the funding you were banking on isn't coming through, or you've churned some customers, or there's a whole load of bugs because you decided to go all in on one stack that only one person on the team knows how to work, and now you need to hire some other people to figure it out, or any number of things. But I think being open to change and being able to adapt is key to survival. I mean, it's probably how humans have managed to still be humans. So I think it's very deeply ingrained in our nature. But I think, yeah, being open to change would be the general formula for making progress. I'm not going to say for success because I don't know what that means.
True. As individual, but, this is why I'm doing it this season, because I'm like, I want to see what everybody says.
Yeah.
I test all different things. I live by the
motto. It's a good question.
Well, I live by the motto of experimentation, and every season I try something new, and I try to go, what will people say if I ask them this? What will we do if we do this? So I always try and experiment to see, because I kind of want, it's a loaded question, right? Because there is no formula, and the formula is, there's no formula. The formula is, it's all individual. Mm. Do a quick fire round.
Oh no, here we go. I've also written some questions today.
You're not meant to give it away that you know the questions. What book do you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
I did write this down, right?
I like you've done your homework, by the way. You're like a school child bringing in your homework to me.
The internet has long since riddled my brain in a way that means I can't actually hold attention long enough to read a full book. However,
that makes me sad.
It's a trade-off. What I will say is there is a book published in 1944 by the organization that is the precursor to the CIA.
Okay. And what a hipster answer. Go on.
They distributed this handbook. It's called the Simple Sabotage Field Manual, a timeless guide to subverting any organization with purposeful stupidity. And they basically handed it to people in industry in, Nazi occupied territories to slow down the war machine.
Wow.
So it was laden with like bureaucratic directions, just like have meetings after meetings, always question decisions after the fact, you cast doubt on this and that, find excuses to not do stuff. But like the thing is, when you read through it, it speaks of how large scale organizations and certain government bodies sometimes slow down through lack of purpose, lack of urgency, lack of direction, probably bureaucracy. And I think founders should read this, because sometimes they might be selling to these people.
Mm.
Sometimes, depending on how quickly they grow, they might hire people like this, and they might end up becoming like that.
I've heard so many founders do that. They get really successful quite quickly. They raise a lot of money, and then they hire experienced people.
And those experienced people are going to do their best based on what they already know. But what they already know are large companies with politics.
Ask a fish to climb a tree. It ain't going to climb the tree. Ask a fish to swim in the water, it's going to swim in the water. And without fail, I've had this over and over. You know, they might have got to like 5 employees. Then they're like, right, we're bringing in the big guns. And they hire from big tech companies, let's call it that. And they're like, Jesus, they don't know how to do anything without a budget of 200K.
Right.
You know, so it's good 200K advice.
200K, man. What you could do at 200K?
Start 5 startups at 200K. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Self-promotion. I hate it.
You're having a real struggle, all right, for the last hour, in fairness.
Well, you do a great job of making people feel comfortable
thank you.
With this kind of setup going on. And it's all about the eye contact. You're doing a great job.
Watch on YouTube if not subscribed. If you want to see my eyes.
I think self-promotion culturally is something that Irish people are conditioned against. And I think that can be a challenge for founders, especially when they go to places where it is core to the culture, like America. And if you don't talk about what you've done and you don't talk about how awesome it was or what you're currently doing and how awesome it is, people assume that you're just not doing anything. Whereas an Irish person, that might be the last thing after, you know, 3 pints that they eventually get around to telling you what it is.
Oh, it's going
grand.
Unless
somebody like you asking questions, right? But yeah,
it's going grand.
It's
grand.
Actually, you know yourself. Just like,
what the fuck does that mean?
Tipping
5K a month, 500K a month. What does grand mean? Yeah, I agree with you.
Right. So I think, first of all, it doesn't come well to Irish people, but yeah, it's a.
What have you sacrificed for your success?
First of all, I don't think I'm successful, but probably mental health.
There's that false modesty again. Mental health, what do you mean?
Startups are hard. Failure is hard. Nobody's really born with resilience. You have to kind of build it up. And like you said, it's not linear. Stuff goes up, stuff goes down. Sometimes it goes really down, sometimes it goes really up. And definitely times where I did not prioritize myself because I was building stuff. I had felt an obligation to my team, investors, that type of thing, customers.
Have you found a way of managing that? Or what's been your strategy to kind of like help?
Talk. You know, when I was a solo founder, doing cohort, that's one of the challenges of being a solo founder. You don't really have anybody to share the burden with. You can't really talk to employees. You could talk to other founders, but, and this is why being part of a community of founders can be really helpful, I think. And it's one of the things that I hope people will use Baseline for, is to be able to talk about the really hard challenges that are not just like fundraising, go to market, shipping product, right? Like the stuff that happens, you know, when you're looking at the ceiling at night, trying to go to sleep, the stuff that's going through your head. And every founder has their version of that. And so, yeah, I didn't have people around me to bounce that off. Mm. And so, yeah, that's what I would look for, people to talk to. And maybe it's a bit selfish, building a bit of a community that I'm part of as well.
It's the old start of thing, solve your own problem.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
If you have it, doubtless more people have it.
Yeah.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
Invest in Baseline members.
Kind of a cheat answer because you're doing it anyway.
Change my mind.
Right. Follow-up question. I'm going to give you 1 million euro.
Yeah.
You can only invest in one person or one company.
Yeah.
Who is it? Don't give me 10. Or you can give me 10. It'll be good for the clickbait, actually. I'll tag them all.
A few months ago, you had Owen Barra on here and he said, he mentioned me to this question. So I'm going to have to return the favor and say Tipple. They're a great team, man. The stuff that they're doing, they're just really foot down and kicking down doors. They're just doing. He's a deal maker. His co-founders Laura and Jamie, just so capable. They're hiring good people. They're also, you know, they're fairly quick to make decisions that are hard to make. They're not really hanging around on uncertainty, and. They're disrupting a kind of an industry that has not really had new ways of thinking for a long time. So not to like beat them up too much. They still have a lot of work to do.
Okay. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
I don't have an answer for that.
Fair enough.
I don't know if I have a daily routine.
Not a routine guy.
Yeah, I don't know if I do.
So you kind of wussed out his answer earlier when I asked you if you start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
It's Baseline. Like we have a 10-year lease in the place. We're all in on it. Like that's it. And the other thing is that, you know, like I don't think I'm employable. I don't think I have the opportunity to do anything else or the headspace to do anything else. This is the thing to focus on that I can make sure people benefit from my experience, good and bad. And I think it'll be a net positive.
I've let you slide on a couple answers, but this one, deliver on this one for me now.
Okay.
Because I believe you have strong answers.
What is it?
What do you believe that other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
I'm going to have to look this one up.
That's all right. You're a man of strong opinions. I'm surprised. I was like, if there's ever a question for Eamon, this is it.
Yeah. That's what I wrote for it. So what do I believe? I don't know if other people strongly disagree or think it's strange. I'm not going to, but I suspect that like the general consensus on this is strange purely based on how the world is at the moment. And the world is fairly polarized. Some for very valid reasons, some for probably not as valid reasons. And there's probably a degree of manipulation going on social media and how people are influenced by different things. And I think there's room for people to be able to hold opposing views in their head at the same time. I think there's room for less absolutes and embracing more of nuance. And I don't necessarily mean things when it comes to you know, war or... But I just think like there are big picture things happening in the world, right? I'm talking about sometimes the behaviors that people really invest themselves in that are those big picture things. They also take them down to the small things that happen, you know, amongst their friends or their family or in communities or whatever, and or in their work. And I think there needs to be more nuance and people being open to being wrong. Or at least being open to entertaining that other people have a different opinion to them. And I mean, as long as those people aren't advocating for like, you know, mass murder or whatever, like they also need
to. As long as you're not harming others.
As long as you're not harming others. There, you know, I just wish there was probably less tribalism or polarization in the world.
Same. I one thing I say all the time is two things can be true simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't always have to be. People want black, white, good, bad, yeah. Hero, villain, the world is full of grey.
Yeah.
You want black and white, but the world is full of grey.
Yeah.
What's one thing you've spent €100 on, thing or experience that brought you immense joy?
I don't have to look down for this one.
Good.
My first date with Fiona Kelly. We went, we drank some Guinness in some of our favourite pubs around Dublin. I don't think it cost 100. That'd be a lot of Guinness.
Okay.
Yeah, there was some food. But yeah, she's my favorite person. And yeah, I think bang for buck, it was good money spent.
Good investment. Well spent. Yeah, what's your favorite pub? Would you remember where you went?
Yeah. We went to the Stag's Head. And there was a few others. But the Stag's Head was
where it all started.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like a very obvious light being shined in my eyes, you know. It was obvious immediately.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm lucky.
What's the one thing you want to leave with all founders? What's one thing you want to, a bit of advice you want to give to all founders?
I wrote this one down as well.
Oh, this is your job. It's important you get this one right.
I think there's so many things to navigate as a founder. Everything from the practical stuff, you know, how do we manifest something out of nothing? This idea that we have in our heads, how do we get it to be something that people interact with, that people find value in, that people pay for? How do we bring other people on those journeys or other people on that journey, like as employees, as teammates, as even co-founders or investors, or either just like other people that would champion? Like, how do we do that? And then, so things have to happen in a very condensed period of time. Relationships kind of have to be built on trust and faith, because you don't necessarily have a year to get to know an investor. You don't necessarily have a year to get to know your first couple of hires or your co-founders. And so when time has to be compressed like that, trust and faith kind of go hand in hand for everybody involved. And one of the shortcuts I've used over the years since secondary school, actually, to figure out whether I should trust something or someone. And it's not always, it's not 100%, right? So, but it might be 80%. I don't know.
Good enough.
But like, yeah, what do they say? What do they do? What do other people say about them? And, anytime I've ignored that, I've regretted it. And so that's worked for me. I don't know if it works for other people. That was how you answer the Leaving Cert English question about how you assess the Othello of Rodrigo. No, sorry, the Othello. How you assess the character of Rodrigo in Othello. That's And so you do it. What does this Shakespearean character say? What do they do? What do other characters say about them?
What a reference.
Yeah.
Pull that out of the bag right at the end.
Mr. Dunleavy, Drimnagh Castle, 1994. He told me that.
Yeah, obviously did a good job. Eamon, where can people learn more about Broadstone, Baseline, and this next thing?
Broadstone.vc, baseline.community, thisnextthing.com.
Eamon.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you so much.
That was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.